Now, 20 years ago, a team of wildlife filmmakers from the BBC's Natural History Unit, they set out to make a television series on the world's oceans, the breadth and scale of which has never been seen before. The Blue Planet, narrated by Sir David Attenborough, was, of course, a massive TV event. And I'm talking here now, I'm going to, you know, if you like, link that in with a thing that's coming up to Belfast at the SSE Arena on Saturday, March 23, and Dublin's Three Arena on Sunday, March the 24th. In 2017, Blue Planet 2 hit our screens to reboot the series with new discoveries and new technology, again treating viewers to incredible sights, but also making clear the dangers plastic poses to these wonderful habitats. Anyway, Blue Planet 2, live in concert, that's what I'm talking about, is coming to Dublin's Three Arena at the end of March, and the SSE, as I say, in Belfast as well. And Orla Doherty, producer of the TV show, joins us now. Orla, very welcome to the programme. It was a massive effort to make this show. What would you say has been the impact of Blue Planet 2?
I think really it's brought the ocean back into everybody's living rooms. You know, we are an ocean planet, but it's so easy to forget that. We live on land. We mostly live in these big things called towns or cities. You know, we live far away from a direct contact with the ocean that actually supports so much life on Earth. And I think that it just brought that message home again, like the original series did 17 years ago.
I mean, like David Attenborough himself had said, he's just astonished, absolutely astonished, I quote, at the results that that programme has had. I never imagined there would be quite so many of you who would be inspired to want change. Just that one word, plastics. Even on the plastics thing, I mean, everywhere you go, banned, 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 isn't it?
Well, that's just been incredible. And, you know, that's a movement that was already, that already had traction. Things were already happening. You know, people have been working on plastics and bringing attention to it for years and years and years. But to be able to play a part in bringing that to a bigger, wider global public attention, you know, having an impact, playing a part in that story, that's just made all of us feel incredibly rewarded for the work that we've put into it. And really, in the end, it's the ocean that's the winner, which means ultimately we're the winners.
Well, Orla, just tell me, like, you know, something about you. You had a pretty amazing life-changing moment in Thailand years back. What was your job at the time and what did you decide to do at that time?
Well, at the time, I was making television in London, not natural history. I was making television with humans, not animals, doing things like Grand Designs with Kevin MacLeod, and you know, programs about fashion and you know, really, really everyday stuff. And I went to Thailand and I was on a holiday and I put my head underwater. I was learning to scuba dive, and that sort of changed my life truly forever, because I saw this world of these fish on this coral reef. And I honestly didn't know what I was looking at. I just thought, have I gone to some kind of La La Land? Where am I? And realizing that there's this whole ocean world that we just don't know. And it is, I mean, it's transporting. It's so incredible. And I think what really got me was the creatures that were living on this coral reef. You know, these weird, freaky fish with these faces that I just could instantly identify with, all these different characters that I'd never seen before. And suddenly these were all my new friends and I wanted to just go and live with them. And so I kind of did, actually.
It's a pretty big one, though. I mean, there you are working with the humans and the BBC and doing lots of different things. And it's a brilliant career in the beginning of the 90s, etc. And then suddenly you go for this thing in Thailand. And then suddenly you say, to hell with this. So you left city life behind. You spent a year winding up your affairs. And what happens? You spend 10 years on a boat.
Yeah. Okay, you make it sound really extreme, but I guess it is.
Well, it is kind of extreme. I mean, like, but did they come up to you and say, how could you spend 10 years on a ship?
Yes.
And what do you say to them?
How could you not?
Right. Where's your family from, by the way?
So dad is Donegal, and mum is from Tullamore, and then her dad was Galway, so sort of all over.
Sort of all over, indeed. So basically you were 30 years of age or thereabouts, and you said, right, this is it, I'm going to try this. So after 10 years at sea, you must have had a pretty clear vision of how human behaviour is destroying life in the sea. Is that what gave you the passion and the CV to get involved with Blue Planet 2?
Yeah, I think that's right. I mean, I came back and initially didn't quite know what to do with all of this experience and all of this exposure and all of this love for the ocean that I'd developed over all this time, and just sort of went back into television a bit by default. And it took me a while. In fact, it took me going to visit my friend in Hawaii and sitting and looking back at the Pacific Ocean thinking, hang on a minute, I'm making television, but I'm not in love with what I'm making the television about. Why am I not making television about the ocean? And then only months later, the BBC announced that it was going to make a sequel to Blue Planet. And so that was my cue to say, hello, you've never heard me, but I think I've got something to, you know, to offer you.
Well, then let's take a look at the specific programme we're talking about that you did, because you worked from October 13 as the development producer to help give shape to the series before working directly on the episode that you produced called The Deep. Now, it's a seven-part series. You spent 500 hours in a tiny submarine. What was the scale of effort to make that show?
It was about 4 years of not really sleeping that well, to be brutally honest, especially the first couple of years when we were just getting going. We were trying to do something that sort of hasn't really been done at the level that we were attempting, which is to really bring the ultimate cinematography that you would expect in a feature film, that you would expect in The Shallow Seas, but to truly bring that that level of artistry into the deep ocean. And that's kind of a major challenge, because just getting into the deep ocean to do anything is already a major hurdle. But to try and bring that sort of level of sophistication, it was trial and error. It was pushing and pushing and pushing. It was it was learning while we were doing and improving and refining, so that, you know, we did, I don't know, something like 10 or 12 different expeditions with different vessels, different ways of doing it. But by the time we did our last all singing, all dancing, doing something truly historical, we were the first humans to dive into the deep sea of the Southern Ocean, just right off the tip of Antarctica. By then we completely knew what we were doing, and it was almost sort of, oh, well, this is just another day in the office. Of course it wasn't. We made it look like we'd always known exactly what we were doing, but it was.
Yeah, and that might have been the way it looked to us. But I mean, like, you know, the logistics, no small feat. I mean, for this 5-week mission, you had, two submersibles, a helicopter, an impressive amount of kit, a crew of about 50 people. You were in three different oceans.
Yes, across the episode, absolutely. I mean, it was really important to represent the deep ocean from around the world, not just, you know, well, we're going to film it all in one little...
As David Attenborough says in the programme, no human has ever descended into the depths that surround Antarctica until now. Were you realising, oh my God, I've got a front row seat to the frontier of scientific discovery here?
Yeah.
That's really what it was it?
Yeah, and, you know, coming from where I came from, which is, you know, I know how hard it is to live out on the ocean. I know the challenges that you're going to face day in, day out, because I did it for 10 years. But then to be doing that, not just at the surface, but to be doing it really at the deep frontier, yeah, I absolutely knew how extraordinary it was what we were doing. And I knew how we were pushing boundaries every single time we launched those subs. And I also knew that we never were going to know what we were going to see when we got down
there.
Well,
that's the point. I mean, obviously it was exhilarating. It was exhausting. Was it perilous? It might have been.
Yeah. Turns out it wasn't. It was nail-biting in a couple of moments, yeah.
I mean, like, you know, if you're going to start going to places that people haven't been, then you usually get Jason Statham in a movie and it's a big shark or something. You know?
I haven't seen that movie. Yeah, I'm not going to.
Well, you haven't missed much. It's terrible. Anyway, it's called The Meg. Anyway, tell us about your time in the submarine and why you were seen eating Pringles.
Because you're down there for hours and hours, and you get really hungry. And also, you know, you can't really move much. If you want to wriggle or stretch, you've got to negotiate it with your fellow cohabitants. And you know, sort of, it's like playing Twister at 1,000 meters. You know, if you get a cramp in your leg, you're a bit in trouble. But we were down. You know, we would go diving for up to 10 hours at a time. So that's 10 hours where you're in this little bubble. There's three of you, and you'd better you know, bring with you what you need and you know, sort of get rid of what you don't want to have down there with you before you go. In other words, go to the loo a lot before you get in.
I'm just thinking, like, you know, you're in a 9-ton battery-powered submersible, and, like, you're only 7 inches of acrylic between you and a kind of pressure that would be impossible for anybody to understand.
Yep.
So anything could have gone wrong.
Yes, and but I guess, you know, it comes down to really getting to know who you're working with. And, you know, that goes with all the different organisations that we work with all across the deep sea. And, you know, really building that relationship, that trust and that faith in their protocols, their safety standards, yeah. their, you know, their way of doing things, their way of pulling out of doing things if it's not going right. And you know, getting to learn where that edge is and then not pushing over it.
Sure, but by the same token, somebody has to be in charge. And if I'm right, you were in charge because you're the producer. Your responsibility to assess protocols, procedures, etc.
Absolutely. But at the same time, I am not a submersible pilot. So that's why I had to get to understand, you know, what are the protocols and who am I working with and what is their background and do they know what they're doing and have they done this 1,000 times before? And are they giving me, you know, the right answers when I'm asking them challenging questions and, yeah. and going through all of that? You know, you can't become an instant expert in how to get out of a troubling situation in the deep, but I can just use my years of experience. My years of experience of being in emergency situations at sea. I've been in plenty of them and they've certainly, you know, made me know what to look out for.
And I mean, could big things have fallen on your head, you know, like a melting base of icebergs or something?
Yes.
Rocks.
Rock, yes. Yes, yeah, so don't dive under a big iceberg.
I mean, I presume, like, when you started leaking, when the water started leaking into the sub at a depth of whatever it was, 450 metres or something, was it like, well, there's nothing I can do about it now?
Well, it was absolutely like that, because truly, what are you going to do about it? You know, I mean, that doesn't stop your heart racing because you know, you don't want to see water in a submarine at 450 metres. But that is exactly what was going through my head is, you know, if we're going to go, we're going to go. There's absolutely nothing I can do about it.
Yeah, but by the same token, the pilot comes along and puts a Band-Aid on it and fixes it. And what do you do? Race back up to the top? No, you stayed there for another few hours.
Oh, no, absolutely. Once he'd sorted it, then... And that's what,
but once he'd what? Defined sorted it?
Why? He said we were fine.
And that's what, then, that's okay then.
But if you have that trust and you understand who you're diving with and you believe that you're with the right team, if they say we're good, then we're good.
All right. And you, I presume, have seen personally heavy storms, cyclones and...
Yeah.
You've lost masts and things. Yeah.
Yes.
All that, yeah, right, okay.
Yes. Yes.
I presume there were thousands or certainly hundreds of hours actually filmed. Could something else be done besides the deep that we saw on TV with the rest of the stuff?
I don't know. There's always more, but it's hard won, and you know, you have to spend an awful lot of time down there to produce not actually that much material.
Yeah.
So no, you know, if we're gonna go and do it again, then we're just simply gonna have to get back in those submarines.
Well, then, were there specific days maybe that you went down, you got nothing, and does that as a producer make you feel kind of slightly worthless? Or, oh my god! Yeah.
No, more than that. There was the very first shoot I went out on. We spent 3 weeks, and I came home with pretty much nothing. And that really did that increased the level of sleeplessness in that first year, because it was just a, you know, we'd gone out to look for this specific thing and everything. We'd, you know, really done a research. We really had confidence that we were doing the right thing. It was worth going and doing the shoot. And it just didn't happen because there was an El Nino event starting, which meant that the ocean temperature was off, which meant that the animals we went to find just simply weren't where they were supposed to be. And that was more than disheartening. It was ever so slightly, just kind of, you know, I slightly lost confidence in myself more than anything else. But then it just takes another trip to go out and get something, and you come home with what you wanted and more besides. And, you know, and that's the nature of filming natural history. You truly win some and you lose some.
Yeah, exactly.
And all you can do is do your research, do your homework, make sure you're talking to everyone and getting all the opinions you can just to make the best judgment call to put you in the best place possible. But it will sometimes just go against you.
Yeah, and it's all more than worth it then, of course, with some of the discoveries that you've made and the thrill of having added to the sum of human knowledge, I suppose I could say. Like, here's an example, the methane volcano, the volcano in the Gulf of Mexico. Tell me about that.
Well, that is a classic case of sort of, you know, expect the unexpected. We did not know that was going to happen. We went completely again through having built a relationship with this incredible incredible deep sea scientist, Mandy Joy. And she, one evening, we were out filming the brine pool 100 miles from this methane volcano. And she just, she'd got to know what I liked. She got to know what I found really fascinating and thought was going to make really good content. And she said, oh, Orla, there are these little bubbles and I think you should go and see them. And she's, and I said, well, what do they look like? And she said, I don't know. I can't really show you a picture. I don't have one. And I said, well, what am I going to see, man? And she said, I don't know, but I just think you should go there. So I got the ship to move 100 miles and the whole crew were looking at me like, you are off your rockers. Where are you going and why? But I guess you just get to a point where, you know, you've worked so closely with someone, and I had trust in Mandy that she knew that there was something worth hunting down here. And that is the day that we filmed that eruption, that nobody has ever seen anything like that before. I don't think anyone will ever see that with their own eyes ever again. And it was just take a chance.
And is it possible that you could go back the next day and there'd be no trace of it at all?
That's exactly what happened.
And is it possible that there would never be any happening like that there at all again?
No, I think it's actually the opposite. I think that kind of activity is going off all the time. Yeah, it's just we're not down there to see it.
If I could sort of put it down to a desert island thing here, what did you find most interesting about being down so deep?
For me, it was that you simply literally never knew what was going to happen next. And that could be nothing for 10 hours or for 3 weeks. But then you had moments like the methane volcano, like the Humboldt squid attacking each other, like the brine pool and these crazy animals around it. And it was just a case of, you know, you just simply never knew what was going to happen next.
And you learned about gender-changing fish and fish that leap out of the water to catch low-flying birds and all that kind of thing.
Yep.
God almighty, it's fantastic. It's certainly better than working with humans in the BBC in the early 90s, I'd say. Anyway, let's just take a look at this there. So what are we talking about here? Do you know much about the Blue Planet 2 live in concert with accompaniment of City of Prague Philharmonic Orchestra conducted by Matthew Freeman at the Belfast SSE Arena Saturday 23 of March and Dublin 3 Arena Sunday 24? Do you know anything about that, do you?
I haven't seen it yet. I will be seeing it. We're going on a massive team outing, a Blue Planet 2 team outing. I can't wait.
Will you get free tickets?
I don't know.
Well, I can tell you this. Blue Planet 2, live in concert. Walruses, killer whales, dolphins, sea lions, tuna, puffins, clownfish and more. Gigantic LED screen accompanied by the City of Prague Philharmonic Orchestra, as I say. Listen, if you do go, Belfast, Dublin or anywhere else, have a fantastic time, Orla. And thank you very much indeed for talking to us on the programme today. Orla Doherty.
Thank you, my pleasure.